Putin won't budge on Ukraine. Today, Friday, March 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Russia continues to ignore Western warnings as the crisis in Ukraine continues. And in Crimea, many ethnic Russians are okay with that. But not this woman.
I thought always that Russia is a kind of like older brother for Ukraine. Right now, I see this violating my rights, violating my freedom.
Also today, Toronto's bad boy mayor, Rob Ford, and his diehard supporters.
They're willing to overlook crack cocaine, lying, and possible drunk driving because they believe that this guy cares about them.
And later, watching the Oscar Pistorius trial on TV.
South Africans have an opportunity to switch over and actually peer into the courtroom, something that many South Africans have never done before.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. After a week of historic high drama on the Crimean Peninsula, what could happen next? That's what everyone's wondering, from nervous Ukrainians in Kiev to people in Crimea and in Moscow, and of course, officials at the State Department in Washington. We'll examine the crisis today from several angles, starting with what Crimeans make of the situation they're in. Just a reminder, Crimea is still technically part of Ukraine, but this week the region settled into a de facto occupation by Russian troops, and pro-Moscow local officials proclaimed that Crimea is now Russian territory and set a date for a referendum in about a week's time. The BBC's Natalia Antalava tells us how residents of the region's capital feel about all of this.
In Crimea, people woke up this morning to a heavy rain and an uncertain future. At a local market in Simferopol, old ladies sell vegetables and discuss politics. These women are pleased that the regional parliament has decided that Crimea should join the Russian Federation. I'm for Putin, this woman says. He'll take care of us. We want to be part of Russia, another adds. Next week, the new pro-Moscow government in Crimea will hold a referendum, which it says will endorse the parliamentary resolution. Officials say they're already working on plans to introduce the Russian ruble. Local political analyst Alexander Furmanchuk thinks it's a very good idea.
I understand the process is painful, but everyone will have to accept it. Russia will get Crimea, and there will be an investment boom here. Our tourist industry will flourish. New roads will be built.
But that image is far removed from the reality of Crimea today. In the last 2 days, several news crews and pro-Ukraine activists have been attacked by pro-Moscow volunteer brigades that patrol streets here. Hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers are locked inside their bases around the peninsula, guarded by the Russian troops. And not all ethnic Russians here support Moscow. Businessman Dmitry Timonov took me on a spin along the coastal town of Saki outside Simferopol. He predicts its beaches will be empty in the summer. Dmitry is Russian, and he believes Crimeans are making a huge mistake.
First of all, no one explained how it will actually work. All our electricity, 70% of our gas supplies, our water, it all comes from Ukraine. This is a peninsula. Our roads, our railways are only connected to mainland Ukraine. Russia can't provide Crimea with electricity. How will this be solved? You know why they are rushing the referendum? Because they're afraid people will start asking these questions.
Public discussion here is limited. Pro-Moscow voices dominate the mainstream media. On Thursday, within minutes after Parliament passed its resolution, several Ukrainian TV channels were taken off air, replaced with Russian networks.
The only news and the only channels I can watch right now is propaganda, like from Russian TV.
In a trendy cafe in the heart of Simferopol, I meet two young Crimeans. Olesya is an ethnic Russian born in Russia. Vadim is originally from Western Ukraine.
Yesterday, I actually cried about the situation itself because I thought always that Russia is a kind of like older brother for Ukraine. Right now, I see this, you know, violating my rights, violating my freedom.
I'm afraid of people being killed. Then if decision is made and Crimea is going to be part of Russia, is going to be part of Russian Federation, I'll have to move out of here, even though I like this place, even though I wanted to raise my kids here. I'll have to move up north or to western part of Ukraine because two worldviews have clashed.
With views so polarized and tensions so high, there seems to be little room for compromise. As Crimea's new leaders rush into Moscow's embrace, many here fear this standoff may lead to war. For The World, I'm Natalia Antolava in Simferopol, Crimea.
With all the drama over Russia's intentions in Crimea, another Russian story has been pushed to the back pages. I'm talking about Pussy Riot. Today, though, the Russian punk protest group is back in the headlines. There is a disturbing video from Russia making the rounds that shows an apparent attack on two of the group's members. Russian journalist Masha Gessen is the author of Words Will Break Cement. It's about Pussy Riot. She says the video is chilling.
From what I understand, this was actually not a Pussy Riot action. Maria and Nadia, two members of Pussy Riot who served 2 years in jail, went to Nizhny Novgorod, where Maria served out the last few months of her sentence, to document some violations at the prison colonies there. They were not there to do a Pussy Riot action. They were in a local McDonald's talking when they were attacked by a group of young men wearing orange and brown ribbons that symbolize Russia's victory in World War II. They screamed, "Get out of town," various other offensive and sexist epithets. And first they sprayed them with a green ointment that is commonly used in Russia to treat infections. They screamed some more, then one of them approached Nadia and sprayed some sort of acid in her eyes. She says that she couldn't see anything for about 10 minutes, and then her vision returned, but her eyes still hurt, and apparently she has some cornea damage. They also lobbed a metal jar of green ointment at Maria, who had to go to the hospital and get stitches on her head.
What do you make of those ribbons, those orange and brown ribbons? What do they suggest to you?
The fact that they were wearing these ribbons, usually they're worn around the time of the anniversary of World War II. The fact that they decided to put them on before attacking Pussy Riot indicates that they thought this was a patriotic act, that they were somehow defending Russia from these women, which is very much the official rhetoric and Putin's rhetoric in relationship to people like Pussy Riot, to political protesters in general. So I think that they got their message from television.
And so that especially patriotic, nationalistic trend in Russia right now, is there a Crimea and Ukraine connection, do you think?
Well, Crimea and Ukraine have both been used as causes for further mobilization. And this is a campaign that's been going on very intensively for at least 2 years and sort of less intensively for the 10 years before that. And it's intensified further in the last few weeks over Ukraine. But, you know, in television propaganda, and I would suspect in these young men's imagination, it's all sort of lumped into one. Beat up the protesters, chase the gays and lesbians, take over Crimea, all of this in the name of a greater Russia.
We spoke earlier to a human rights activist in Nizhny Novgorod. She told us these two women, as you say, were taken to the hospital, and she believed it was not staged. And she said they seemed really frightened. Is this going to get worse?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to predict something like that. I am extremely worried for their safety. The entire state propaganda machine has worked for months, actually for years at this point, to sort of portray them as enemy number one of the Russian people, of the Russian Orthodox Church, of the Russian state. It's an extremely violent country, and that message of hatred, we shouldn't be surprised at all that that translates into violence. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if it translated into life-threatening violence.
If these nationalists are getting their messages from Russian television, is Vladimir Putin able to control the entire scenario? Is he able to control these nationalists? I mean, he can control the television. We know that.
The thing about the Putin regime, and this has been true actually for many, many years, is there are certain people who are sort of declared outside the bounds of the law. It's open season on some people, and that is why we have seen a lot of the political murders, a lot of the murders of journalists. All of these murders have gone unsolved. Do I believe that Putin personally ordered most of these murders? No. He just made it very clear that that those people could be attacked and killed with impunity, and he had created a system in which impunity was guaranteed. And Nadia and Maria are marked women. They're in that part of society on which it's open season. And nobody has to order the attacks in order for the attacks to happen.
Masha Gessen, the author of Words Will Break Cement, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brazil has seen its share of anti-government protests over the past year as it prepares to host the World Cup. Right now, though, people are focused on Carnival. The street celebrations and parades wrap up this weekend, but it's not all about the partying. As Catherine Osborne reports from Rio de Janeiro, this year's Carnival has political overtones.
Rio State Governor Sergio Cabral was a big target of last year's protests in Brazil. And now he's being ushered out of office. It's not his real exit. He's actually leaving in a few weeks. But this is a roving party of more than 1,000 people ceremoniously expelling him. Many of the partiers are dressed as indigenous Brazilians. That's because last year the governor made headlines for forcing native Brazilians out of their cultural center next to the Maracanã Stadium, a World Cup venue. Plus, Cabral has the same last name as a European explorer who led the colonization of Brazil in the 1500s. To the protesters, Carnival is a good time to kick them both out.
Carnival is a moment where people are already on the streets, where the great gray city becomes colorful, where people change their routines and do spectacular, magnificent, and you know, unique things.
That's Tomás Ramos. He's one of the organizers of a group of artists, musicians, and protesters called Occupy Carnival. They planned the governor's exit parade, and they rewrote lyrics to 14 traditional carnival songs to reflect topics such as public anger at government spending on the World Cup.
I'll pick this one. It goes, se você pensa que a Copa é nossa, a Copa não é nossa, não. A Copa é das empreiteiras, não sobra nada pro povão. What it's saying is, if you think the World Cup is ours, the World Cup is not ours. The World Cup is for the big businesses. Nothing is left for the people.
Some of the other parody marches touch on the harsh treatment of Rio's informal street workers and the use of police force against protesters. Samba historian Luiz Antonio Simas says Brazilians have a tradition of using music at carnival to send a message.
Quando, por exemplo, a ditadura militar termina,
he says during Brazil's military dictatorship, open dissent wasn't permitted. So the lyrics of carnival marches became a space where Brazilians could slip in messages of support for democracy. Now they can speak openly. But Sima says carnival is still a time when people shed their costumes of everyday life and show who they really are. Tomás Ramos of Occupy Carnival says the music is a way to draw people into discussing the things that really matter in their lives.
Right now, Rio de Janeiro especially, but cities in general, are a very hard place to live. The costs are higher every day, and the quality of the services are lower every day. The city is a place where money is freer than people.
Which is why you'll find Ramos, feather headdress on, leading a carnival protest march to the Maracanã on Sunday. For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne, Rio de Janeiro.
We're at PRI.org when we're not on the radio, and let me remind you about another cool way to find The World, the Flipboard app. Flipboard takes our radio show and basically turns it into a magazine whose pages you can flip through and at the same time hear all the voices you know from The World. It runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device, and you can find it at flip.it/PRI. That's flip.it/PRI. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Did you catch this on Jimmy Kimmel's show this week?
If you operate under the impression that local politics are boring, you probably don't live in Toronto. Our first guest tonight has tripped, bumped, danced, argued, and smoked his way into our national consciousness. He's here tonight because I put him on my vision board and he appeared. Please welcome Mayor Rob Ford.
Yep, that's Kimmel introducing Toronto Mayor Rob Ford. He probably needs no introduction at this point. Ford became fodder for the late-night shows after getting caught on video smoking what he now admits was crack cocaine. His out-of-control drinking and inclination to cuss are also well-documented, but the mayor has not resigned and, in fact, is running for another term. Robin Doolittle of the Toronto Star was one of the reporters who broke the story of Mayor Ford's cocaine use. She's also now the author of Crazy Town, the Rob Ford story.
Some have characterized the situation as the death of shame. A lot of politicians that we see ensnared in political scandals or sex scandals or drug scandals resign because they're embarrassed. They don't want to come to work every day and be asked questions like, were you taking photos of your genitals and texting them to people? Rob Ford comes to work and reporters ask him, you know, were you drunk driving last night? Are you still using crack cocaine? Did you have a prostitute in your office? And he's content to sort of be asked those questions. And that's a bit of a powerful thing when in terms of his ability to stay in office.
And he's running again, is that right?
And he is running again. And the latest poll had him tied for the lead.
Wow. You know, south of the Canadian border really does sound and look like Toronto is crazy town. But the point of your book is that in order to understand Ford and his relationship to Toronto, you got to understand Ford's own family background. So what was the one story you heard about his family's kind of perennial dysfunction where you really started to get who Rob Ford is?
Trying to pick one. I set out when I was writing this book, I set out to answer two questions. One, how is it that a city like Toronto, which is sort of like the New York or Chicago of Canada, most people think it's progressive, it's left wing, it's environmentally conscious, culturally inclined. And how is it that they elected this guy who seems better suited to sort of Tea Party politics in some way? And secondly, who is Rob Ford? Why is he the way he is? Why does he do the things that he does? And when I was setting out to answer that second question, you couldn't avoid the family, his family's influence. And for one thing, there's this tension between Rob and his brother, Doug, who's a city councilor. And they pretend to be best friends, but there seems to be some mistrust there and tension, and you see it flare up in policy debates. Doug will sometimes hijack the message and things will unravel. There also seems to be this inclination to lie whenever they're confronted with something that's unpleasant. And so when I was doing my research, there was this one big thing that jumped out at me. Their father, Doug Ford Sr., was a member of provincial parliament. And in the 1990s, he grew up in the Depression, dirt poor, self-made millionaire, started a label company, became very wealthy, and eventually moved to politics. He had four children. And the first two struggled with hard drug addiction, and then Rob obviously has his issues. In the late 90s, he stored some money in his basement in a tin can behind a brick in the wall, and he realized it was missing one day. And what his reaction was to hook up his four grown children to a lie detector test to see which one had stolen it. I think that that's something that a lot of people can't necessarily imagine happening in their own home. But to me, it was just such a telling detail about the Ford's family's relationship with telling the truth and lying. And that was the detail that really stuck out for me.
And then in 2006, Rob Ford's father died. You think that that's kind of a turning point when Rob Ford himself moved from abusing alcohol to going to crack cocaine?
I found evidence of hard drug use, particularly cocaine, as early as his 20s. But trying to pinpoint that moment when a guy who maybe partied too much transitioned into having issues in his personal life that were impacting his professional life, I did focus in on the time period when his father died, speaking with people who were close to the Ford family, close to the mayor, even extended members of the family. The consensus is that incident was so devastating to all of the Ford children that really seems to be a time when things began to unravel.
Rob Ford admits he's a flawed person. Do you see good qualities in Rob Ford?
Yeah, I mean, everyone, of course, has good qualities. I think Rob Ford, the big takeaway from Rob Ford for other politicians is that Rob Ford spent 10 years as a city councilor building a brand as someone who cared about the little guy. If you were a constituent in Rob Ford's ward and you phoned him because you had a problem in your neighborhood, maybe leaves weren't being collected or streets weren't being plowed or there was a pothole, he would call you back and he would show up at your door with city staff and try to get your issue fixed. And even if he wasn't able to get your issue fixed, you had this feeling that, wow, that guy really listened to me. He really cared. And over the years, he built up this loyal group of followers who felt that, you know, if it was any other counselor, any other politician, I'd call, I'd get their office, I'd get put on a wait list, an executive assistant might call me back, nothing's going to get fixed. But this guy will take my call and he cares. And I think that that's the big takeaway for other politicians, is that people feel so disenfranchised, unheard by their elected officials, that they are willing to overlook crack cocaine. They're willing to overlook ties with illegal street gangs that police say are smuggling guns into the city. They're willing to overlook lying and possible drunk driving because they believe that this guy cares about them.
Robin, you're clearly a solid journalist who covers your bases and gets the job done. I guess your career would have been made eventually by one story or another, but it was made by this one. So how do you feel about your career being made by this guy, Rob Ford?
I made my own career in the sense that I investigated a story that others weren't, that was in front of me. But I certainly do sometimes sit down and think, you know, if I die, the first line of my obit will have Rob Ford in it. I will be tied to this guy for the rest of my life. I guess that's just how it is.
Robin Doolittle with the Toronto Star. She's one of the reporters who broke the story of Mayor Rob Ford's crack cocaine use. She's also the author of a new book about the whole saga called Crazy Town, the Rob Ford story. Robin, great to speak with you again. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Politics also play a role in our GeoQuiz today. So we're looking for a country that just recently got a new prime minister. At 39, he's the youngest prime minister in his nation's history, and he wants to shake things up. First thing he did in office, named a cabinet that's evenly divided 50-50 between men and women. That's a first for this European nation. Now the new prime minister is trying to change the electoral law. The new law would give an automatic bonus of extra seats in parliament to whichever party gets the most votes. This would be a huge change for a country known for its myriad political parties, complex governing coalitions, and as a result of that, crumbling and indecisive governments. Parliament is debating this new law, but passage has been delayed because female lawmakers want the new measure to include a so-called pink quota. What's that? I'll explain when I come back with the answer later in the show. News headlines are next. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the Oscar Pistorius trial grips South Africa.
It's almost like a soap opera, a crime series that South Africans are really addicted to at this point. And I don't think I've ever seen so many South Africans focusing on a crime-related court case like this before.
We'll hear what transpired in the courtroom this week.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Talk about a high-profile case. In South Africa, they're calling the trial of Oscar Pistorius the trial of the century. Pistorius is the double amputee Olympian charged with the murder of his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. Her shooting death last year in Pistorius's home made worldwide news. Now the trial has South Africans glued to their TV sets. Gia Nicolaides is a reporter for Eyewitness News in South Africa and has been covering the trial.
It has been an emotional week, especially for Oscar Pistorius. He had to sit in the dock and listen to the testimonies from several neighbors, a friend, a restaurant owner, and an ex-girlfriend who spoke about what type of person he was, but also a neighbor had actually arrived at his house on Valentine's Day last year and saw him next to Reva Steenkamp's body praying out loud, saying that if she survived, he would dedicate his life to God. Now, this particular neighbor called Dr. Johann Stipp actually described how he assessed Rivas Steenkamp, checked vitals, and then noticed a head wound. And he said after looking at that, he knew straight away that she was already dead. Some really gory details coming out of his testimony on all her wounds and how she was carried down the staircase from Oscar's home in Pretoria.
Wow. Now, it's been called the trial of the century. I think we've heard that phrase before. But it's not only like it's the O.J. Simpson case for South Africa, but it seems to be bringing out questions about South Africa's past. I mean, some of these white Afrikaners who are testifying almost seem to be out of step with post-independent South Africa.
Yes, I think so. And at the same time, it's also bringing up issues which South Africans have to face every day. For instance, crime. The fact that Oscar Pistorius actually woke up in the middle of the night and claims to believe that there was an intruder in his bathroom is something many South Africans feel on a day-to-day basis. The fact that he carried a firearm for safety all the time with him is something that many South Africans do because of the high rate of crime in this country.
This is a very high-profile case. There's been a channel dedicated to covering it. How's it being talked about among South Africans?
I think South Africans are loving it because they are following this case blow by blow as it's happening. It's the first time we've had a trial TV in the country where people actually get to see what happens in our courtrooms, something that many South Africans have never done before. So it is shining a spotlight on our justice system and the way the courts work, but it's also educating South Africans to a large extent. Many of them talking on TV and social networks, etc., are saying that they didn't know that witnesses actually had to go through all this questioning and they feel quite uncomfortable about it. But at the same time, the same way that many South Africans and people across the world are addicted to crime series where they put pieces of the puzzle together to try and find out the truth at the end of the day, it seems very much like that for South Africans with this particular case. Everybody has an opinion about it, but everyone is waiting for those details. Did Oscar Pistorius kill Rivas Steenkamp by accident, or was it premeditated murder?
So what's the next step in the trial, Gia?
The next step in the trial is a security guard who works at the Silverwoods estate where Oscar Pistorius lives. He started testifying today. Cross-examination will continue on Monday. What he said today was quite interesting. He said that he was doing his patrols, his rounds at the estate, and he had passed Pistorius' home less than an hour before the shooting, and he says that everything seemed normal. After 3 a.m. that morning, they got reports from several neighbors saying that they had heard gunshots. He phoned Oscar Pistorius because they had indicated that it was coming from his house. And he said that Oscar Pistorius told him that everything was fine, but he did notice that he was crying. So he rushed over to Pistorius's house, walked into the house, and there he actually witnessed Oscar Pistorius carrying Rivas Steenkamp down that staircase.
Wow. Gia Nicolaides with Eyewitness News in South Africa. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we heard the story of two women, a refugee couple from Cameroon. They fled their country because it's a crime to be gay there. When they arrived here in the U.S., they faced new hurdles as they tried to settle in. Today, we hear about a program that's trying to give gay refugees a softer landing. The World's Monica Campbell has that story.
We're in a kitchen in a San Francisco home, and there's some serious dinner prep happening. There's one woman here, slender, with long reddish-brown hair, busy with the appetizers.
My name is Selma. I born in Iraq, Baghdad, Iraq.
She's in her 30s, Muslim, and moved here recently. Growing up in Iraq, her mom spoke to her in English.
She used to speak to us. It's like, good morning, let's go, you know, speaking English, singing, you know, it's like English. And my mom, she like Abby.
Abba.
Abba. Yeah, she liked right. Abba. Yeah, seriously, you know.
Soon after the invasion in 2003, Salma started working as a translator for U.S. troops.
I was with them when they got hit in Fallujah, and I almost lost my life.
And the danger continued. She began getting threats.
Threats because I work with, you know, U.S. government and, you know. And my brother, I work with my brother.
He was a translator
too. He was a translator, but him and my mom, they got killed. And that's why.
That's why she fled to Turkey. She doesn't know who targeted her family, but she feared being next. In Turkey, she was granted refugee status for her work with the U.S. military and got approved to come to the U.S., a place where she could feel free in another way, too. Salma is intersex. She was born with sexual anatomy that's both male and female. Salma identifies as a woman and looks and sounds like a woman. She was considered female by the U.S. military, but was classified by Iraqi officials as a man and felt ostracized. So that brings us back to this home in San Francisco, where she lives now with her new roommates.
Sit. Good girl.
My name is Ruben Zeltman.
My name is Erica Katsky.
They met Salma when she arrived at their doorstep from the airport. It all happened pretty quickly.
They had just gotten notice that the person was coming, and so they were looking for housing.
The couple's part of a small pioneering program for refugees like Salma. People who arrive here alone, who faced persecution because of their sexual identity, and could use extra support. Jewish Family and Children's Services of the East Bay created the program. Volunteers receive a small amount of rent from the newcomer, and they, in return, help with life here. Here's Zalman.
Well, I'm transgender myself, although Salma's story is very different from mine. I grew up in Los Angeles, but I do have some understanding of what it means to not be safe in the world and to not really be welcome.
Katsky and Zalman, who's also a rabbi, have helped Salma with the tricky navigation of getting recognized officially as a woman.
How do you change your name and gender? Mm-hmm. How is it appropriate to speak with a person whose gender you might not be clear on? What questions are okay to ask? Mm-hmm. There didn't used to be a form at the Social Security Administration for gender change.
Salma is still getting her footing, but you can tell she feels at home.
I'm lucky. I'm blessed because I live with them. And I realized that I love them with their dogs also.
She loves the dog the most.
Uh-huh. No. Come Otis. On. Otis. Well, let's say Otis. Otis. I realized that they respect you. Whatever, if you are intersex, trans, or whatever it is, they believe in you. This is the family.
After we talk, it's back to cooking. There's apple pear cobbler, sweet potatoes, gravy, turkey. Okay, it's not November, but Salma got here in late December and heard about the feast she missed. So she made a request.
Re-Thanksgiving.
Re-Thanksgiving, okay.
We're using my aunt's recipe for sweet potatoes with marshmallows. And she was looking at the bag of marshmallows. She's, what is that?
Welcome to America.
For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, San Francisco.
A different kind of gender issue is at the heart of our geo-quiz today. We asked you to name a European country where gender parity is at the heart of the political debate right now. The answer to the quiz is Italy. The country's new prime minister, Matteo Renzi, favors gender parity. He proved it by naming a cabinet with an equal number of male and female ministers. That was a first for Italy. But now the female members of Italy's parliament are pushing for more. They want the country's new electoral law, a key part of Renzi's reform program, to include a so-called pink quota of 50%. That means two things. One, a guarantee that half of all candidates for political office be women. And two, a guarantee that half of those elected also be women. At the moment, about 30% of Italian lawmakers are women. If that sounds low, consider this. Here in the U.S., only 18% of congressional seats are filled by women, so Italy is already ahead of us on this one. By the way, the country with the highest percentage of female lawmakers, Rwanda, with a whopping 64%. Next, we're going to hear from a woman who wasn't officially elected to the U.S. government, but she did have the ear of the president. That president was Ronald Reagan, who called on historian Suzanne Massey to explain the Russian worldview. Pretty heavy task. Massey met with the president regularly for a number of years. Their conversations are the subject of her latest book, Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me. Suzanne, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you, Marco.
I want to start by talking about your role in the White House during the height of the Cold War. In 1984, you met President Ronald Reagan for the first time, and your task explaining to him the Russian worldview. So remind us what you told him.
Reagan was the only politician I ever met who really wanted to know not what did the Kremlin think, but what did the Russians think. No one had ever told the President of the United States that the Russians were religious. And even though it was being persecuted and even genocide, that they hung on to it. It was the only non-Marxist-Leninist thing to be able to exist at all.
And in your book, in your wonderful description of that first meeting, Reagan is kind of like, I've never heard that before. It's like a aha moment for him.
It was. I think that humanized the Russians for him in a way that he could understand. And in fact, because he was always worried that if they had no morality, they might engage in world expansion and even in the nuclear Armageddon, his word. And so he began to talk about religion with Gorbachev in private. So I think that was perhaps the most important thing I told him.
Now, your big claim to fame, if we can call it that, is a phrase that's in the title of your book, Trust But Verify. It was a Russian phrase that you introduced to Reagan, and we actually have Reagan using it with Russian Secretary General Mikhail Gorbachev. Let's hear this clip.
The importance of this treaty transcends numbers. We have listened to the wisdom in an old Russian maxim. Though my pronunciation may give you difficulty, the maxim is dovayai no provayai. Trust but verify.
На каждой встрече вы это повторяете.
You repeat that at every meeting.
That's a wonderful piece of tape there. So trust but verify, Suzanne Massey. What is the story behind that Russian expression? Where does it come from?
Well, it's an old Russian expression, very old. And I was having lunch with President Reagan and Mrs. Reagan just before Reykjavik.
Big political summit in Reykjavik.
I said, Mr. President, you know, the Russians often like to talk in proverbs. And there's one that might be useful. And I said, you're an actor. You can learn it in a minute. So I said, it's doveryai no proveryai. Trust but verify. Well, he leapt on it. And so did Mrs. Reagan. And then he made it his. And it has passed into the American lexicon. And I will tell you a little something I just learned a short time ago by someone, a reporter who had a long interview with Gorbachev. And he asked him, when did Gorbachev realize that he could really work with Reagan? And he said when he used a Russian proverb.
Mm. You know, the present generation always seems to think it knows more about the past than its predecessors, but the predecessors also thought the same thing when they were in power. And that's one of the striking things in your book about that meeting with Reagan, that first meeting and his inner circle, just how much the Kremlinologists in the room didn't know. Hadn't even considered these things that you were telling them about Russia. So what do you think are the big missing pieces that the Obama administration doesn't get right now about Russia, Ukraine, Crimea, the whole thing?
History, particularly in this situation, is critical. Ukraine did not exist as an independent country until 1991, and it had not been, quote, taken over by Russia. It was part of Russia. In fact, Kiev was the birthplace of Russian civilization, so it has been Russian since the 9th century. Crimea, even more, it was won by the Russians in the 18th century from the Ottoman Turks and annexed peacefully to Russia in 1783.
It sounds like, Suzanne Massey, you're making a case that Russia has a legitimate claim to Crimea, maybe even a legitimate claim to all of Ukraine.
I'm not arguing for Putin at all, but I'm just saying that there are things we consider that we have a sphere of influence. We almost went to war over Cuba, and it's wise to remember that when there was Grenada, a tiny little place, where suddenly Soviets were building airfields, Ronald Reagan did not hesitate one second. He sent the Marines, and he said, oh, he was protecting the American citizens. Well, there are only a handful of medical students there. We consider that our sphere of influence. We seem now today to have denied the Russians any right to a sphere of influence. We don't recognize and consider that they have a sphere of influence, too.
Suzanne Massey, Russian scholar and the author of the just-published Trust But Verify. Thank you very much for coming into the studio, Suzanne. Great to meet you.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up next, the hot tunes on the radio in Montevideo right now on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We don't usually feature music from Uruguay, but today we have three musicians from the country we're going to tell you about. They'll be performing at South by Southwest down in Austin, Texas next week in a showcase dedicated to Uruguayan artists. Our friend and frequent contributor, Beto Arcos, joins me in the studio to tell us about these three artists. Great to have you in our studio for a change, Beto. So Uruguay at South by Southwest seems kind of random. How did this focus on Uruguay start?
You know, over the past few years, I think a lot of people have come to find out about that little country tucked between Brazil and Argentina called Uruguay. Well, the country that gave us a man by the name of Jorge Drexler, who won the Academy Award a few years ago for The Motorcycle Diaries, the best song.
Right.
Jorge Drexler is one of many, many singers, songwriters, bands, and so on. And the country has one of the richest musical traditions, folk music, in South America. And so I thought, hey, why don't we hear some of that music? And I brought a few of them.
All right, so who are we going to hear first?
The first singer we're going to hear is a fantastic vocalist by the name of Ana Prada, who happens to be a cousin of Jorge Drexler. This is her third record, and we're going to listen to a song called La Entalladita. It's a beautiful folk song that she reinvents, and it's about this man who says to his soon-to-be wife, watch out, don't put that dress on, because, you know, there's people out there that are going to look at you.
Roberto Businio le dijo a Teodora, respeta el cariño, que cargo pistola, la llevo con ocho tiros. Ese vestido pegado a tu talla y tan atrevido, recuerda que soy alcaide y muy pronto tu marido.
So a song from Uruguay's Ana Prada. It's got a kind of traditional lilt to it. Is this the kind of song you would hear on pop music radio in Uruguay these days?
Yeah, I would say yes, because as I said before, Uruguay has a great tradition of folk music, but it's music that's been played on the radio, and people love this music. And I think what she's doing here with this particular tune is she is reinventing it. She is kind of updating it and saying, well, we can also hear this song this way.
Let's hear the second artist you want to tell us about. This is Rosana Tadde, yeah?
Milonga pa' recordarte, milonga sentimental. Otros se quejan llorando, yo canto pa' no llorar. Tu amor se secó de golpe, nunca dijiste por qué. Yo me consuelo pensando que fue traición de mujer. Varón, pa' quererte mucho, varón, pa' desearte el bien, varón, pa' olvidar agravios porque ya te perdoné. Tal vez no lo sepas nunca, tal vez no lo puedas creer, tal vez te provoque risa verme tirado a tus pies.
She sounds a little on the more senior side compared to Ana Prada.
She has about a dozen records, you know, already in her pocket. And this is, I don't know if you noticed, but this is a very much almost like a tango. It's not a tango. It's actually one of the genres that made tango called milonga. And it's a classic milonga by really major composers from Argentina, Homero Manzi and Sebastián Piana, Milonga Sentimental.
Va a quererte mucho, varón, va a desearte el bien, varón, va a olvidar agravio porque ya te perdoné, tal vez.
It's got a fantastic beat, Beto. I got to say, music is not the first thing I think of these days when I think of Uruguay. I think of their unconventional progressive president, Jose Mujica. He drives a VW bug, legalized cannabis, and so on. But they do have these incredible artists. Briefly, if you had to kind of generalize what the typical music of Uruguay is and where its pop music is today, what can you tell us?
Well, Uruguay in the region is known for one particular rhythm. It's called candombe. It's a rhythm that has an African root, and it was obviously brought to Uruguay by slaves. And it's very popular, especially this time of the year, because it's the carnival. It's the music that they play during carnival. They also, because it used to be long ago, hundreds plus years ago, it was part of the Argentinian Republic. Uruguay is also a country that built its own identity, and it has an incredible amount of songwriters, singers that in the 60s and 70s created this body of work. I mean, I'm in Mexico. I grew up listening to Alfredo Zitarrosa, to Los Olimareños. These are singer-songwriters that we came to appreciate all over Latin America.
Considering you grew up listening to a lot of these artists, I'm curious, are Latinos in the U.S. focusing at all on Uruguayan music? Is this an interest for them?
Not yet. Jorge Drexler has opened the door and has said, hey, we're also down here, you know, just like the Argentinians, but we are our own country. We have our own rhythms and traditions. You know, check us out. And I think he helped, definitely.
The last artist you're going to tell us about is a guy named Daniel Drexler. He's Jorge Drexler's brother. Is Jorge Drexler just in charge of kind of a creative dynasty in Uruguay? Because Ana Prada is his cousin.
It's you know what? That's a good question. I think that there's just a lot of talent. And it just so happens that in his family, there are several musicians, singers. And, you know, I think you may be right.
So give us a quick thumbnail then on Daniel Drexler.
This is his fifth record. And I think, in my opinion, I have one or two of his previous ones. I think he's really growing into a songwriter, into a great composer of songs. And in this particular tune, we're going to hear a little bit of the candombe beat that I was telling you about. And a beautiful song that speaks about sort of where he's at right now, about being in the open sea and see what happens.
Aferrarse al mástil en medio de la tempestad, saber recobrar el aliento. Siempre habrá algún idiota en algún lugar, jugando con dinamita, jugando con fuego. Cada día amanece con un nuevo reto. Tan solo sentirte latir ya es un gran suceso. Salir a la mar con las velas al viento. Mar abierto, mar abierto.
New music there from Uruguay's Daniel Drexler. He'll be performing in the Uruguay Showcase next week at South by Southwest. Beto Arcos, great to have you with us today. Thanks for coming in and telling us about these artists. Wonderful stuff.
Pleasure to be with you, Marco.
Mano firme sobre el timón, en medio de la tempestad, oído sordo al canto de sirenas.
We've got videos for all three of the artists Beto just told us about at PRI.org. And next week, we'll introduce you to more artists performing at South by Southwest. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you next week.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org, the Ford Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.